Hello, and welcome to the Center for International Law, National University of Singapore, special COP26, a series of discussions with leading experts and industry leaders on the issues which are at the front and center of the climate change discussions. I'm Danielle Yao, adjunct senior research fellow and the lead on climate change law and policy at the center. And it is my immense pleasure today to welcome a good friend, Professor Christina Watt from the University of Oslo. She is also recently elected chair of the ICUN World Commission of Environmental Law. And very pertinently, for the purposes of our discussion today, the co-chair of the Paris Agreement, Compliance and Implementation, or rather should I say PAICC, the acronym, if I got it right, the Paris Agreement Implementation and Compliance Committee. What is it? What does it do? What has it achieved? What is the road ahead? I can think of no other better person than Christina to lead us in this discussion today. Christina, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being our guest on the show.
Thank you so much, Danielle, for this kind and warm welcoming. It's a pleasure for me being here, and I'm looking forward to discussing the Paris Agreement Implementation and Compliance Committee.
Thank you very much, Christina. Now, the Paris Agreement, the COP26, has really dominated the headlines this week. Everybody's talking about the slew of commitments, the slew of pledges, financial commitments, mitigation, enhanced mitigation targets. But what is perhaps not heard in this noise is the role or even the existence of the PAICC. Now, how can we increase the awareness of this mechanism? What is the PAICC in the first place? What is this mechanism under Article 15 of the Paris Agreement? Would you like to share your views a little bit on what this committee is intended to do?
Absolutely. The PIKE, as we call it, PAICC, the Paris Agreement Implementation and Compliance Committee, PIKE, was established in the Paris Agreement itself in Article 15. That means it's already a couple of years old as a mechanism, as a committee. And it was interesting. I was personally involved for the delegation of Norway in the negotiations of that Article 15. And for the longest time in the negotiations of the Paris Agreement, it was unclear whether there would be any compliance element in the agreement. But when we ventured in the hottest final phase of the negotiations in Paris itself, it became clear that it was to become a necessary design element of the Paris Agreement, an architectural element, a building stone of the agreement, something that complements both the general obligations of parties to have an NDC, for example, the transparency framework, but it has then the possibility to pick up on whether parties comply with their obligations through the implementation and the compliance committee. The agreement itself only has a very few provisions, only really establishes the committee, but in the Paris Agreement rulebook, which was adopted in 2018, there's a whole decision 20 CMA1, that sets out the modalities and procedures for the committee. And there we find, for example, information of what kind of issues can come to the committee and how to deal with it. But just to give a general answer to your question, the compliance committee, implementation compliance committee, is a design element which was meant to enhance mutual trust and confidence among parties, but also to increase the effectiveness of the Paris Agreement.
Do you call it some sort of an accountability mechanism? Would that be an accurate description of it?
Most definitely. Mm. Yeah, an accountability element or mechanism is exactly what I usually call the compliance committee, because it holds states in a way accountable to their pledges, to their obligations. Mm. But it's not only an accountability mechanism, it's much more than that. It's also something that is supposed to enhance capacity and just increase the potential for parties to live up to their obligations and commitments.
Well, thank you for that. I think one question that might be of interest to the listeners now would be, really, what are the powers of this committee? What was it designed to do? Or perhaps a more pertinent question is, what was it not designed to do? Because typically when you think about a mechanism for compliance in other international instruments, one immediately thinks of, you know, a binding, forceful mechanism with penal sanctions, for example, some sort of penalties or even some sort of sanctions for non-compliance. But is this what this committee is supposed to do, or actually not supposed to do? I think it might be useful to perhaps demystify some of the questions that others may have about
this committee. It's a bit of a mysterious creature, that's what I call it. It's not so well known, and therefore I'm very grateful for this opportunity here to talk a little bit more about it, because there's a lot to be explained about the compliance committee. But first of all, it's supposed to function in a facilitative, non-punitive manner. Mm. It is supposed to facilitate implementation and promote compliance. From the outset, it was very clear that it won't have any powers to impose sanctions or fines or any other punitive measures. But it provides the possibility to pick up on whether parties have fulfilled their core obligations or not, their core legal obligations. And as we know, there are far and few in the Paris Agreement. There are few and far in between.
And then there's also substantive and procedural.
We have the core legal obligations. Yes. There are really only a few for parties to communicate and maintain a nationally determined contribution, Article 4, Paragraph 2. Another core legal obligation is to report under the transparency framework, to report a biannual transparency report. It's also an obligation to participate in the Facilitative Multilateral Consideration of Progress, the FMCP. And in addition, there are some obligations that only apply to developed country parties, for example, to communicate information under Article 9.5, that's the
financial
communication and finance. Yeah. So these core obligations can be picked up by the compliance committee, where the committee looks at whether a party has fulfilled these obligations or not, but only in a facilitative manner, which means that the committee would engage in a dialogue with a party concerned, probably sending a letter asking, can we talk to you, what's happening, you don't have an NDC, what are your challenges, how can they be addressed, can we help you? Mm. And so from that dialogue, probably over a course of time, that it will show what kind of solutions can be provided or not, and whether that situation can be resolved. If not, then the committee can also suggest the development of an action plan. So where the party itself says, these are our challenges, this is what we need to do, within that time frame, we're going to get back into compliance.
And that's a voluntary process, presumably.
Well, it's not a voluntary process. Once the committee is engaged in it, it is engaged in it.
But the party will have to, in that process.
But the party would be asked to provide this plan. However, if that all fails as the ultimate measure, and maybe the most, in a way, punitive one, if I may use this term, is that the committee can issue finding of fact, where it can issue a public statement that a certain party is not in compliance with obligations. But that's the most forceful measure that can come out of this, is to issue a finding of facts. But we know in international relations, reputation is very important.
Indeed.
Pride is very important. Mm-hmm. No party likes to be asked or called out by a committee, so it can actually be very forceful if applied, even though it's a soft measure, but it can have really hard effects.
I think I would certainly agree with that. I mean, given from my background, from my experience, I think for countries, it's often underestimated how the soft elements of diplomacy can actually be very effective. And also, not just effective, but more, I would say, welcoming, and better able to attract perhaps a consensus and agreement for the mechanism in the first place. And this might actually be a little bit of a trip down memory lane, because I can imagine there are others while looking at this mechanism, and we're in a situation, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson had mentioned, 1 minute to midnight, and there may well be calls and questions as to why the negotiators did not draft something or provide for a mechanism that was more forceful. Perhaps you could share, since you were very much a part of that journey, for others who were not there, to explain why this was this discussed, why was it not included at the end of the day?
It was definitely discussed. As I already mentioned, the inclusion of a compliance mechanism or committee was something that entered the negotiation process of the Paris Agreement fairly late. Mm. As you perhaps know, the negotiations started out with a Durban mandate, and out from the Durban mandate, there were some elements defined that would go into the Paris Agreement. Compliance was not among them. And I do remember when, for the first time, I made an intervention on behalf of Norway in Lima in 2014 and mentioned compliance, and there were several parties who just jumped in their chair and said, "How can you?"
I can imagine.
Because
the uproar.
There were two different reactions. There was the one reaction saying, "This is beyond the mandate. We never talked about compliance, not going into this agreement." And there was the other part who they were concerned about if there were a compliance element, it would lower the stringency of the obligations. It would water out the obligations, because parties would be concerned that they would be hit with hard compliance measures.
Yeah.
So you have to see the structure of the committee now in this context, where we managed to include a compliance committee, but with a facilitative nature, in order to address those concerns by some parties. Mm. Of course, there were suggestions that the committee could impose suspension of rights, for example, or punitive measures or whatever, but that did not succeed. In the end, it's, as always, a compromise, and the alternative would have been no compliance.
Which would have been even worse, in my view.
So the compromise was okay, it will not have the most forceful legal measures, but it's there, and it is, as you rightly said, it's an accountability mechanism, and it can eventually be very effective.
Very effective, yeah. I mean, we are sort of at the beginning of the implementation process, and I think all eyes will then turn to the operation of this PIKE. Would be of interest to know, since the PIKE was established in December 2019, I believe, if I recall, in Madrid, what has the PIKE been up to? Perhaps others would like to. It would be very, very much interest. Now, I, of course, I asked that question with a little bit of a...
it's a fair question, Danielle. It's completely fair. Just to be correct, so the committee itself was established in the Paris Agreement itself. Yes. What happened in 2019 was that the first members were elected.
That's right.
So it suddenly came into life.
Into life, yes, that's what I meant.
So that happened in Madrid with the first set of members. Not all regional regions nominated members, so we were a little bit short of what actually was the maximum number of members. We then met for the first time in June 2020, and by that time the pandemic had already hit.
That's right.
Which meant that the committee only, until actually here at this COP in Glasgow, had only virtual meetings. So we've met five times in 2020, 2021, five times in a formal meeting, and had four informal meetings. So we've met nine times in those two.
Very hardworking committee.
Hardworking committee, but all in the virtual format, which of course is a little sad because the members didn't know each other.
Sometimes
couldn't meet each other.
A bit challenging, I would imagine.
Very much, and sometimes it just needs a cup of coffee and some friendly words. And we couldn't have that over Zoom or Teams or whatever we use. But what we did work on for those last 2 years is a concrete mandate that we got from the CMA in Katowice, which said that the committee was supposed to work on its draft rules of procedure. Mm. These are some more technical, detailed elements that negotiators weren't able to agree on in Katowice and pushed it a little bit down the road, like conflict of interest provisions, voting provisions, and that kind of thing. So that's what the committee worked on for the last 2 years, and we sent a draft of the rules of procedure to the CMA for adoption here in Glasgow.
Now, thanks very much. I mean, I think the road ahead, as I said, is just the road ahead. And the question here is, perhaps our next question would turn to the process. The committee is made up of members that are independent experts acting in their individual capacity, but ultimately they're also nominated by states. How has this got any impact on the way negotiations have discussed? Has the committee nonetheless shielded from some of the more politicized discussions we have seen elsewhere? So that's one question. The second question is, I suppose, relating to the operation of the committee itself when it does start looking at issues. One question that has come up is, of course, the transparency of the proceedings and the accessibility of these proceedings. And we have seen a lot of stakeholders, civil society interest as well. Are you in a position to share anything on how that would look like when a matter comes before the committee?
Let me address your first question about the individual expert capacity under which members are working. Mm-hmm. Yes, many members are indeed civil servants. Some members are law professors and other non-civil servants. When you come in as a civil servant, I think it's very difficult to take off the hat that yours represent your government. And that is kind of enhanced also in that virtual format where people were kind of being very careful with what they said and not stretching too far from their country positions general in the negotiations. So I think it's understandable situation, and also because it was very new. It was absolutely new. Nobody, we all had to do things by, start to take one step after the other and find ourselves, find our way how to work with each other. So I think many committee members did bring in also some of their respective party positions, but I think that's very understandable. Mm. If that led to rather politicized discussions, now the nature of what we were supposed to do, these rules of procedure are technical issues, so they don't really lend themselves to the most political discussions. Mm. Of course, you come into questions of differentiation between countries and that sort of thing, but I think we managed quite well to draw it down to technical discussions time and time again, even if they got political at some point. I think we landed it quite well. So, and to your second question about transparency, that's an important one, because those meetings that I mentioned, they were all closed meetings, so they were not open to the public. And the reason for that was that the committee, in a way, had to find itself. It had to find a way of how to work, especially in this virtual setting. We were all kind of overwhelmed by that situation, and it was felt by several committee members fairly strongly that we needed to do this behind closed doors, because we just had to find a way to elaborate our way forward, which is of course difficult, and there were also committee members who would have liked to have transparency, but in that very new setting, I think it was understandable that there was a majority of members who preferred to have the piece of confidentiality to start working. But in the rules of procedure, which are now for adoption before the CMA, this is supposed to change, because there is a procedural rule which, as a default, says that all meetings will be open to the public unless they are closed because of confidentiality requirements, which turns around the mode of working that we had so far, and says in general all meetings will be open unless for parts of the meeting they can be closed and you meet in camera, because it may be dealing with issues that are confidential and concern a particular part.
Yeah, I can imagine it's always in the negotiations and even setting up this committee in the first place, it's a question of balance. At what point, because we are trying here in the pipe to encourage parties, in fact, to come forward, to seek the committee's assistance, in fact, to facilitate implementation and encouraging the compliance. And it's got to be a kind of a safe space for them. So the question is really the balance as to when that space, that trigger or that threshold is crossed. I suppose we will only know when the committee starts looking at the matter substantively, that you will be able to perhaps come up with some internal working criteria to determine when the door closes, so to speak, to the public.
Yeah, exactly. So we left it open what these situations would be, where the committee may feel that it needs to close the door. But there are confidentiality requirements already in the decision from Katowice, which says that if the committee deals with the issues of an individual party and they're confidential, then it has to close its proceedings. But you're absolutely right that the committee has to start working, take its first steps, and it will probably show quite quickly how this can be operationalized. Yeah. But I just wanted to pick up on something that you just said, and I forgot to mention in the beginning. That's the question of how can actually an issue get to the committee? How when can the committee get active? And there are basically three ways. The first way, and that's important, I think this is also a little bit under-communicated or under-known, is that a party can always come to the committee. If a party faces some implementation challenges, for example, in setting up its new national adaptation plan or its new NDC or whatever it is, it faces challenges, it can come to the committee. And the committee can engage, for example, with support mechanisms and bodies under the Paris Agreement to try to figure out how that party can be helped and supported in implementing the provision of the Paris Agreement. So that's one way.
That's the facilitating
implementation.
Sometimes under stress, everybody focuses on compliance.
Yeah, because
forgets about
exactly. But there's a reason why it says implementation and compliance.
Yes.
Because implementation is much broader, and it's really a facilitative support function to parties, to help parties to overcome any challenges that they may face. That's the one way of getting to the committee. The other is what I previously mentioned, is where we have a situation where a party is not fulfilling its core obligations, for example, communicating an NDC. In that situation, the committee will get active on its own behalf. So that wouldn't have wait for a party to come, but the committee can get active on its own.
And the committee will be relying on like a synthesis report from the secretariat?
On information from the secretariat, for example, of which parties have an NDC in the registry, which is currently an interim registry. Hopefully sometimes it's a registry, but the secretariat will follow up and look at which parties.
And flag it up.
Flag it up to the committee, exactly. And the third way is an interesting and quite complicated way, is it links actually back to the transparency framework. And in particular, in those situations where the technical expert review reports, the technical expert review teams will go through each biennial transparency report, and then the technical expert review teams will issue a report on how well a party did in reporting. And if these reports point to persistent and significant inconsistencies of a party's reporting, then in this situation, the committee can take up this issue and function in a way as a backlog to the transparency framework. But in this situation, this is only possible with the consent of the party concerned. Mm-hmm. So the committee cannot just get active here, but it has to reach out to the party and require its consent. And if the party doesn't consent, then it just stops there.
And there's the TERR, the Technical Expert Review Report, plays a critical role in this, because that's where these inconsistencies are actually flagged up.
Exactly.
Which brings me to a point that I'm glad you raised, which I did want to canvas this with you, because there's a clear link to the ongoing discussions now in the Transparency Contact Group.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue, based on what I understand from the latest discussion this week, that particular issue of ascertaining what is this creature, what is this threshold, persistent and inconsistent, significant inconsistency, has not really been resolved. And even who is looking at it? Is it the TRR? Is it the PIKE? Are they supposed to consult each other? Do you have any sense of that? Are you able to share where you think the road ahead? Because I think the road is not clear at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we included this
particular possibility in the modalities and procedures in Katowice. I was the co-facilitator of these negotiations in Katowice. There was a lot of thinking put into how this could actually work.
Yeah.
And what negotiators were thinking at that time was that it would be the committee itself, you know, looking at the technical expert review reports, it would be the committee who would determine whether there are persistent and significant inconsistencies.
Right.
These would not be terms that we would find in the reports from the technical expert review.
Okay.
It's not that the technical expert reports would say, and here we have a significant and persistent inconsistent.
No,
it's something might be good, but no, and that would be something that the committee, with the help of the secretariat, would determine on its own.
Mm.
For example, if there's an inconsistency which was pointed out in the
previous report. Okay.
It happens again, and it concerns quite a core reporting obligation,
yeah.
Then that's something where the committee could say, but this is persistent and it is significant,
mm.
And here we act.
Mm.
But what has happened now exactly is that now also in the transparency negotiation, some parties said, well, in the outline for the technical expert review report, we should include that the technical expert review reports identify persistent and significant inconsistencies.
Mm. Mm. So this is the $6 million question.
Well, hope not.
Where will it land? Watch this space. We might know this week or next where this will land.
But I think the transparency negotiators are probably well advised to leave it to the committee. They have a lot to do already.
Oh, they have
putting,
so much to do.
Putting this,
yeah,
on top of it. And I would also think it goes a little bit outside the mandate of what the transparency negotiations currently are looking at. They're looking at the outline of
the
paper.
Looking at the outlines of the BTR, the DRR,
exactly.
All these reports. These, so many issues are still up in the air. And
yeah.
Well, I think I wait with bated breath to see and figure out as a lawyer, as a legal practitioner, as a climate change observers, will be very, very keen to know the content, I think, of this phrase and what it means. And because it's going to be a very useful guidepost, I think, for parties in their implementation.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just don't know, and this kind of guidance is very helpful. And again, it's in the context of a safe, fairly safe environment nonetheless, because it is still, at the end of the day, not intended to be punitive.
Yeah,
I hope,
yeah,
that is
yeah,
the calling card, so to speak. I wonder also, if I may ask, in how the committee is going to operate in factoring in the principles of CBER and the unique national circumstances. How will the committee take that into account? Do you anticipate this being already reflected in the submissions that comes up? Is it something you anticipate the PIKE having to inquire proactively? It's a new novel mechanism, and I think there are quite a lot of curiosity as to a little bit of a crystal gazing, I admittedly,
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But what do you think is going to happen as a co-chair? I thought it might be useful.
As a co-chair. Well, I don't know. We have to see how the committee operates once it starts operating. From a principled perspective, of course, we had long discussions in Paris, but also in Katowice, of how to, or if at all, relate to differentiation between parties. It's understood that every party is,
mm,
different, that several separate respective national circumstances. But the understanding was, at least in Paris, but also in Madrid, that this is already reflected in the other parts of the Paris Agreement, you know, how in the national determined nature of contributions, in the flexibilities, in the transparency framework, everywhere is taken care of that there are differences of parties. By the time an issue comes to the Compliance Committee, it was actually very important for parties in Paris, at least, that there everybody would be treated equally, that there wouldn't be any distinction made based on CBDR or something when an issue comes to the Compliance Committee. But this is history in the negotiations. But of course the committee will have to look into different reasons for why a party is meeting challenges.
Mm.
What are, there may be capacity constraints, there may be higher in some developing countries than developed countries. there may be financial issues. Of course, there could be significant financial constraints that could lead to implementation or even compliance challenges. And I think in the context of looking like on a case-by-case basis of what exactly are parties facing, the committee will take into account respective national capabilities and circumstances. This is what is written into the Article 15.
And I've seen that, and I've heard that phrase also repeated across different negotiations. It's a key core principle.
Absolutely.
The parties are very concerned about. That's wonderful to know. Perhaps, I mean, and it's been a wonderful conversation. Time has just flown. Unbelievable. But I just wanted to just end with perhaps a question and an observation. And it's an encouraging observation, really, because it just was mentioned even in the conference that we both had this morning, the report from the IEA, that if all the pledges and commitments that were announced, at least in the course of this week, apparently they have done an analysis, and it means the world will be on track for 1.8 degrees, which is encouraging, very, very encouraging. But the big caveat being, if they are in full.
Yeah.
And that is the thought I would leave here, because I do think the PIKE would also, not just the parties, but PIKE would actually play a part in this accountability and facilitating implementation, promoting compliance. All three limbs come together to make this possible. So that's really my kind of a concluding observation. But I would leave that with you for your comments. And also one question for you. And I'm sure you've been asked this by others, but I will ask you. What are your hopes and what are your expectations of COP26? Obviously, one hope that they converge, that your hope and your expectations converge.
Yeah. Well, let me first reflect a little bit on the issue of achievement of NDCs, implementing and achieving NDCs, which is of course crucial. You know, one thing is to point them or to communicate them. Another thing is to really achieve.
That's true, because there's also a gap between, not necessarily a gap, but there is a process that the commitments made at the political level, let's say, by the leaders, needs to be translated firstly to the NDCs, and that's really what we're looking
at. That's where they have to go, or the long-term strategies, if they are beyond 2050 or something. I think it's really interesting to think about what is the role of the compliance committee in this context. And I dare say that it does have a role. First of all, as I said, any party can always come to the compliance committee with implementation challenges, and these could be challenges with regard to implementing your NDC. If a party says, okay, we have set us this target, but we are facing challenges in implementing them, it could come to the committee and say, please help us. Could we find ways of how we could improve our implementation? The second aspect which is important here is that the committee in itself will not assess whether a party has achieved and implemented its NDC, because it's not a legal obligation of parties. So the committee will only assess issues like this if a party wants that. And then to your question about the way forward, and what first of all, my hope for the committee is that parties start using it on their own, that they try to see what the committee can actually do in increasing the effectiveness of the Paris Agreement and helping parties to achieve their NDC. I think if parties are more proactive with the committee, it might help also the committee to find its way. And with regard to the COP, here we have a bit of a mismatch between the expectations that are out there and what can actually be delivered.
We're on the precipice of an existential crisis.
Absolutely.
That's really the sense around the room and outside the room.
Yeah. I think the COP will have to deliver on two things. It will have to deliver in motivizing and getting parties to close the ambition gap and to close the finance gap, maybe more on a political level, on a higher level, than the concrete negotiations can deliver. But it will also have to deliver on finalizing the rule book
for implementing the Paris Agreement, because we need to finalize that so that all the processes under the Paris Agreement can kick into motion and deliver on these pledges that parties have made. I think this is equally important, and the COP will be judged on both elements for its success.
Thank you very much, Christina. On that note, both encouraging as well as cautionary, it has been a delightful conversation, a really, really wonderful conversation. I thank you so much for your time and for sharing, despite all the technical, you know, as viewers were here, all the technical challenges that we've had and background noise and equipment. But it's been a very enjoyable, I would say, it's been about 40
really?
Minutes.
Time flies.
Time flies.
No, thank you so much. thank you so much, Danielle. It's been a very interesting conversation for me as well. I really like to share my views about the committee, apparently. But I hope also that the audience and whoever listens to the podcast gets some more detailed information about the committee out of it.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you, listeners. I hope you enjoyed this episode and in the series of specials from COP26. Thank you and good day.